This is the Plain Dealing Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. This is Adam Miller. I'm the preacher at the Plain Dealing Church of Christ, and we are glad you're listening in today. And the sermon that's going to be on the podcast today was not delivered here at the church building in Plain Dealing, but was at the Sarepta Church of Christ on April the 4th of 2023. I was invited by Darwin Hunter, the preacher there, to come and speak on a series with multiple other speakers. The theme was, We Wish to See Jesus. And my topic was assigned as the Triumphant King. I've had people asking for more content on the podcast, and I thought I might start recording some of the sermons that I deliver when I'm away from home and add them here. So hopefully that'll be a benefit to you. And it was a wonderful sermon series. It was a great speakers, great church at Sarepta, and I really appreciate their invitation to be there. And I hope that this sermon will be a blessing to you. Here is the Triumphant King.
Very much the opportunity to be included on this series of sermons. I appreciate the songs that were just led, and specifically that last one, as we seek to hear the story of Jesus. You know, from John chapter 12 and verse 21, the foundational text for our whole theme really this week, we see that there were people who wanted to see Jesus. Sir, we wish to see Jesus. They come and ask Philip. And we see here that they are wanting to meet this interesting person that everyone's talking about. And you know, when you've met someone for the first time, and especially if it's someone maybe sort of famous or someone who's well-known or popular or highly regarded, you might spark a lot of interest. And when I look around the room tonight, I see that most of you, at least I think so, I can say this safely, that the majority of the people in the pews tonight that you're not thinking about or studying about or spending time meditating on Jesus for the first time. In fact, it may be the 100th or the 1,000th time that you've thought about him and his life. And so that presents quite a challenge as we seek to see Jesus tonight. I hope that I can do one of two things, or a couple of things here. One is, I hope that I can teach you something new that you've not known about Jesus. I hope that I can give some context to this theme that perhaps you've not heard, or make some points that you've not considered. And secondly, by doing that, I hope that you will renew your desire to know more and more about Jesus, because he is the most magnificent man that ever walked on the face of the earth. And tonight, as we study together, we're going to see that he is also someone very special. Now, of interest to me tonight, the theme is going to be the Triumphant King. And what's so interesting about that to me as I'm dealing with this theme and putting together this sermon is that the triumphal entry has actually just happened in John's Gospel. So I hope you'll turn there to John chapter 12 to our text where Philip is asked, hey, we wish to see Jesus. There's a reason that these people wanted to see Jesus. And it's because he was the person that everyone in Jerusalem was talking about. In John chapter 12 and in verse 12, the Bible says the next day, a great multitude that had come to the feast, when they heard that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem, took branches of palm trees and went out to meet him and cried out, Hosanna! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, the King of Israel. Then Jesus, when he had found a young donkey, sat on it, as it is written, Fear not, daughter of Zion, behold, your king is coming, sitting on a donkey's colt. And his disciples did not understand these things at first, but when Jesus was glorified, then they remembered that these things were written about him, and that they had done these things to him. Now tonight, it's interesting too that this falls where it does, because if you look at the religious calendars that are kept by some in the religious world, the coming Sunday ahead of us will be what's called Easter Sunday. It lines up with the Jewish Passover, which is the date when Jesus was crucified and then resurrected that weekend. And so our religious world, there are a lot of people who celebrate that and call that the Easter holiday. The Sunday before that, the past Sunday that we just passed, if we were on that same calendar, would be called Palm Sunday. You may be familiar with this. In fact, if you know anyone who is Catholic, you may have seen them about 40 days ago, give or take 4 days. They would have taken and had some black ashes on their forehead, And those ashes are from palm leaves that are burned and put together because of this Palm Sunday. They're looking ahead to Palm Sunday. Now, I'm not advocating you do any of that stuff, but I'm just framing this as we are here in this point in time in the calendar year, that it is interesting that we're talking about this situation or this circumstance that surrounded Jesus' entry into Jerusalem that we commonly call the triumphal entry. Now, as we're going to see tonight, we are going to observe this event from three different viewpoints. The first one is we want to look at the different narratives that are found here in John 12, also in Matthew chapter 21. You're going to find it in Mark 11 and also in Luke 19. And if you go and read all four gospel accounts, you'll find that all four of them include the triumphal entry. Now, I want to stop for just a moment. That's important. We have four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, respectively. Matthew, it is said, is written to the Jewish audience to convince them that Jesus was the expected Messiah. Mark, it is written, it is said, to the Roman audience to portray Jesus as the perfect man. Luke, who often references people like the Samaritans or Gentiles in his narrative, it is said, is written to the Gentile world to show that the Messiah was also for them. And John is the one that is sort of unique, written the last in the gospel sequence, and he states his purpose is that we might believe that Jesus was the Son of God. And so every gospel has a different purpose. It is thought that they all had probably a different audience and a different thrust behind them. And because of that, they are not all exactly the same. Now, Matthew, Mark, and Luke are known as the synoptic gospels. That is, they are similar in their narratives. And so you can take them many times and you can read about Jesus' travels and read them alongside one another and get many more details. There are very few events, however, that are recorded in all four Gospels. If you were to look for all of the things or all of the Gospels and find the similar or same event, for instance, you won't find the Sermon on the Mount in all four Gospels. You won't find what's called the Olivet Discourse in all four Gospels. You won't find the Last Supper in the same exact telling in all four. You won't find the foot washing event after the Last Supper, but in John's Gospel. There are a few things that are found in all four Gospels, and I've always thought when we find them in every Gospel, that means they're really, as we say here in the South, really important. They're really important. And they're really something that we need to pay attention to. For instance, one is the feeding of the 5,000. It's recorded in all four Gospels. The resurrection of Jesus and the crucifixion of Jesus, the trial of Jesus, all four Gospels. Those are important things that have special significance. Well, why would the triumphal entry be recorded in all four Gospels? It is because it means quite a lot to that audience that lived concurrently with Jesus. And it should mean quite a lot to us as well. This is one of those stories when I was a kid that I don't remember hearing a lot at Vacation Bible School or in Bible class. We hear about the triumphal entry. The picture that I had on the screen just a moment ago, and I'll back up. I remember having that picture in my home as a child on the wall. And we found out after many, many years, there's actually a dog over there on the left side. If you have that picture, you can find him too. He was in our house for many years and we didn't know it. But at any rate, That picture, I always, what is that? That's the triumphal entry. Well, what was that all about? And I never really understood. If Jesus walked on the water, that made sense to me. That showed that he is supernatural. If Daniel went into the lion's den and the lions didn't eat him, that was something special. I could remember if the world was flooded and Noah built the ark. But what is the significance of Jesus riding a donkey into the city of Jerusalem as people cry out, Hosanna to the Son of David, and throw their clothes on the ground? Well, tonight we're going to look at it from these three viewpoints. The first one is, Jesus was showing himself as the expected Messiah, the Son of David. Now, I want to go back to another triumphal entry, and we don't have time. I don't want to keep you here all night, but I hope you'll jot down that first scripture reference there in 1 Kings chapter 1 and read it in its full context. That is, go back into 2 Samuel and then read through into 1 Kings, because there's a narrative there that is quite important. Now, there is the narrative begins in 1 Kings that David is old. And you may remember that they try to sort of pep him up and revive him. They bring in a young woman to be a wife or a concubine for him. And they think this will sort of get the blood flowing and revive him. But age had set in on the great king like it will on all of us. And David was nearing the end of his life. And his fourth son, Adonijah, takes advantage of this situation and proclaims himself essentially the successor to his father David. And he rallies some support. In fact, some generals, some commanders that had been David's join him, and some other important people in the kingdom join him, and he rallies some support. Now, this becomes crisis mode because David had intended that the son he had with Bathsheba, Solomon, would be the successor and the new king of Israel. And so they begin to scramble and they begin to put things in place. And David surrounds himself with good men. But to make this long story short, there are a couple of things here that happen. One of them is Solomon is put on David's mule. Heard one man say that's like the president letting the vice president fly on Air Force One. I don't know if that's true or not. I suspect Air Force One's a little nicer than David's mule. But by riding on the king's mule, it signified to the rest of Israel that the king had authorized his son to have his authority. There was a symbol there. And the second thing that happens is that Solomon rides into the city across the brook Kidron from the east into Jerusalem as the people proclaim him king and as he is anointed and crowned king. Now, you probably didn't know that story. And I don't mean that to pick on you. I didn't really know that story for a long time. And I certainly didn't think about it having any connection to Jesus in Matthew 21, Luke 19, Mark 11, and John 12. But the fact of the matter is, what David did is he said, "This is my son who will be the son of David and the king of Israel." And so Jesus chooses not a horse, but a donkey to ride in on into the city of Jerusalem, crossing that same path from the same side of the city, coming in a similar fashion to Solomon, thus claiming, "I am the son of David and I am God's chosen heir." And so for all the Jews who knew their history very well, this would have been a scene when Jesus comes through this path, riding on this specific animal, in this specific circumstance, they're all going to think, "This is the son of David who comes to build the new temple." Remember, Solomon came and built the new temple. What's Jesus going to do? Come and be the temple builder. And by the way, Solomon was really the picture of Christ. Now, we talk about David being a picture of Christ, but Solomon was the one who built the house for God. And Solomon, but he came up short, and he was not that perfect king who ruled with perfect wisdom and peace. And so God is essentially saying there will be another. Jesus is the true Solomon. That's part of what's being framed here. Now, the reference we're all more familiar with is from the book of Zechariah, chapter 9, verses 9 and 10. And one of the reasons we're more familiar with this is because it's quoted there in the text in the New Testament. And so Zechariah had seen this event through the eye of prophecy, and he pronounced it for Israel. He says, "Rejoice greatly," verse 9 of Zechariah 9, "O daughter of Zion, shout, O daughter of Jerusalem, behold, your king is coming to you. He is just and having salvation, lowly and riding on a donkey, a colt, the foal of a donkey." And so we have this quotation inserted in the New Testament text around this triumphal entry to remind us that Jesus does this to signify that he is the coming king that Zechariah had prophesied. And so the first viewpoint that we need to see the triumphal entry from is from the viewpoint of the Jew who was expecting the new king to come into town and sit on David's throne. Now, there's another viewpoint we need to take into account tonight, and that is the viewpoint of the domineering governor. Now, of interest, and recently we've been in our Bible class on Sunday morning talking about biblical archaeology, and we've talked about some archaeological finds that confirm the Bible. Biblical skeptics for many years mocked a lot of the people and places found in the Bible, specifically before archaeology really got going. And now we have dug up things like the city of Jericho, and for some reason, they can't figure out why, archaeologists can't, the city of Jericho, they said all the walls fell outward, and they don't know why. Well, it's back in the book of Joshua. But we have found steles, for instance, the Sennacherib prison, and we found steles, and we found other ancient historical artifacts. Recently, there was one just in the last month that was recently interpreted that has a reference, a Moabite stele that has a reference to the house of David. And I'm sort of a history nerd, and I watch and read all these things. And I follow the Biblical Archaeology Review and all this stuff because I like to read about these things because they're of great interest to me. But I say all that to say that one of the characters in the New Testament who is mentioned multiple times is a man by the name of Pontius Pilate. And in the last century or so, there was an ancient artifact found that has his name, not just Pilate, but has the full name, Pontius Pilate, identifying him as the governor of Judea during the time of Jesus. And so the biblical narrative was not making him up. You know, occasionally you'll find someone, maybe it's probably more than likely online, but you may be talking to some skeptic and they'll say, well, you know, Jesus wasn't even a real person. Well, with all due respect to that person, they are completely ignorant of history. Even the atheist scholars, the most anti-biblical, anti-God atheist scholars, there are virtually none today who say that Jesus never existed. Because of things like finding the evidence for a real person named Pontius Pilate. And we have a ton of historical evidence. But let me get around to what this viewpoint for this is. Pontius Pilate was the governor of Judea. He had a large area that he was responsible for. And his home was not in Jerusalem. Because no self-respecting Roman would live around all of those Jews in the center of their religious world all the time. He didn't want to have to deal with them. He made his home on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea in the city of Caesarea, or as we sometimes call it, Caesarea. And in Caesarea, Pontius Pilate would leave to go to the city of Jerusalem around their big feasts. There were six feasts a year that the Jews were to go and celebrate, three big ones out of those six. And one of those was the Passover. That's when a lot of times they would get very, you know, nostalgic about their nation and start mumbling about the coming Messiah. And he wanted to make sure he was right there so he could keep a finger on the pulse of what was going on in the Jewish world. Now, I've read from multiple scholars, many people have romanticized this and said that on the same day Jesus is coming into Jerusalem on the donkey, that Pilate was riding on his white war horse into Jerusalem. I don't know if it was the same day. Some sources say it was a few days before. Either way, the narrative is the same. Pontius Pilate came into the city of Jerusalem from the west, coming from Caesarea, and he came in the west gate of the city on a war horse with a Roman legion showing a strength of force and saying, "We are in control, we have the power, we are here to rule you and you'll behave." Jesus comes in and is proclaimed king, the one who has control, but he comes in from the east side of the city of Jerusalem riding on a donkey and not a war horse. And so that's a perspective we need to keep in mind, that Jesus here is coming in. And you know, some historians say that the triumphal entry was made up, but as has been observed, Jesus coming in on a donkey with a few people, you know, right after they had the giant parade for Pilate coming in, either that day or a few days before, would have seemed like just sort of a small notation on their day. So the domineering governor is another viewpoint we need to take in mind. The third and the final one is the spectacle of the Roman triumph. I want to go back to the book of John here for just a moment. And here we read in verse 31 that Jesus says, "Now is the judgment of this world. Now the ruler of this world will be cast out." Now that's very important that this is in the context of the triumphal entry. Jesus said when he came in on that donkey, "Now the ruler of this world will be cast out." Well, what do I mean by Roman triumph or a Roman triumphal entry? Without going too history nerd on you this evening, please bear with me for a moment. If you've ever heard of a man by the name of Pompey the Great, he was the primary antagonist to Julius Caesar. They were primary rivals for power in the early Roman triumvirate, in the first Roman triumvirate. And Pompey the Great was a man who was, by all accounts, great, had won many victories and had accomplished many things. And the Romans had as their lord, their founder's name was Romulus. And they believed and taught, although there's really no early evidence for this, it was probably more of an origin myth that had developed, that Romulus, when he won a great victory, came into the city of Rome, and they threw what was called a triumph for him. And that is, he would ride in a chariot, four horses wide, and there'd be a great parade, and he would come in with all the spectacle. Well, not to be outdone, Pompey the Great had three of these triumphs. But the triumph before the emperors, before the Roman Republic became an empire, the triumphs had to be granted by the Roman Senate, and it was only for the highest ranking officials. It wasn't something that happened every day, and it had to celebrate some really monumental victory. And so for Pompey to have three of those in his lifetime was really spectacular. And one of those went for 2 days, which never happened. Most time it was a one-day parade and you're done. Pompey said, we're going to go 2 days on this one. And so he really extended it out. So he would ride in the chariot, four white horses wide. Many times history says that the man in the triumph parade, that he would have his face painted red to mirror the god Jupiter of the Romans, to show that he was now part deity, or he was, you know, giving glory to the deity, but now he himself has become a god through this, and he's coming into the city, and this is all happening to show the people how great he was. Now, there's a lot of things that happened. Number one, he gave out gifts as he came in. So if he goes up to Gaul and fights a war in Gaul and conquers those people in modern-day France, he would bring back their treasures and their, you know, exotic animals and things like that. And he would march them through the city, and they would throw out free bread and maybe some free trinkets and things to the people. And all the people are celebrating. And the other thing that would happen, they would also bring the greatest warriors, and specifically the generals and leaders of the opposing army, and put them in that procession and bring them into the city of Rome. And by the way, last note here about this. This is the only time that a Roman general was allowed to enter the city of Rome under arms, was during a Roman triumph. Now, not to be outdone, Julius Caesar, after conquering Pompey, had four triumphs. And I believe he had one that was a 3-day. So he outdid Pompey on every. And later we have men like Caligula who had a triumph over the ocean. Now, Caligula was a nut. But at any rate, it goes downhill when they can throw their own triumph. But at any rate, this Roman triumph sets a stage for a lot of biblical texts that may not mean much to us. And so when we think about Jesus as a triumphant king, we have the Jewish perspective. We have the perspective of the citizens of Jerusalem thinking about the governor versus Jesus and how they're going to rule through power. And now Jesus makes this statement that now the ruler of this world will be cast out. Well, let me ask you a question. Is Jesus a triumphant victor that week? Because a week after he enters, by the way, those palm branches, John is the only gospel writer to tell us that palm branches were cut. There are other gospel writers tell us about people putting their clothes on the ground. We go back to the book of 2 Kings. We find that this is emblematic of them honoring the king, that the king shouldn't tread on the ground. He should tread on our clothes. And so we see that that's carried forward. But the palm branches in ancient Jerusalem times and this society were used to signify victory and triumph. And 1 week later, Jesus is dead and in the tomb. By every measure, by the Jewish expected Messiah measure, he didn't succeed. Pilate put him to death, and he did not bring his enemies into the city in shackles, but he himself was imprisoned and put to death. And so by every worldly measure, Jesus has fallen short of the expectation of what it means to be a triumphant king when he's nailed to that Roman cross. But remember, he said, now the ruler will be cast out. In this moment, I will be the triumphant king. There are a few texts. I remember my Uncle Wayman when I was a young preacher, he would always just ask me, "Rand, what does this verse mean?" And we were at Freed Hardeman University one time for the lectureship, and we're walking around, and we sat down for a minute, and he said, over in Ephesians 4, and he quoted the verse I'm about to read to you. He says, "What does that mean?" He said, "Don't tell me now, you need to go study it." And I went and studied it, and I didn't have any sort of resources there at the hotel room. I had my Bible, and I sort of came up with an answer, and he said, like that. And I knew I didn't satisfy his curiosity. But I want to read this text to you, because here in Ephesians 4, we're all very familiar with verses 1 through 6, the verses surrounding the concept of unity in the church. "I beseech you, therefore, brethren, to endeavor to keep the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace," etc., etc. Notice what he says in verse 7, 8, and following. He says, "But to each one of us grace was given according to the measure of Christ's gift. Therefore," he says, now quoting from an Old Testament prophet, "when he ascended on high, he led captivity captive and gave gifts to men." And he said, what does that mean? And I said, okay, well, we have the time frame. It's when he ascended. But what does it mean he led captivity captive? And I had no idea what in the world that meant. Hold that thought, and let's go over to the book of Colossians for just a moment. Colossians chapter 2, the other reference you see on the screen there. And we'll jump down to about verse 13. But remember, in context, Paul is talking about the spiritual circumcision of the heart that occurs in our baptism when we're saved from our sins. And he says in verses 13 through 15 of this text, he says, "And you, being dead in your trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, he is made alive together with him, having forgiven you all trespasses, having wiped out the handwriting of requirements that was against us, which was contrary to us, and he has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross." Now here's the verse of interest. When he did all that for us, notice what it says. "Having disarmed principalities and powers, he made a public spectacle of them," notice the word, "triumphing over them in it." Now, if I was a Roman citizen or a Jew living in a Roman world, everybody knew about the Roman triumph. Even if you'd never been to one, you'd heard stories of the great Roman triumph, because after the triumph, they'd have games, or they might bring in giraffes from Africa and have them in the thing. For the first time, by the way, elephants were brought into Rome, and it terrified the people when they were brought into that first triumph. And so the people would talk about these things and celebrate these things. And so when they heard these words in Ephesians 4 and Colossians 2 about principalities and powers, that is rulers, other rulers, being disarmed and being made a public spectacle. And when Paul says that when he ascended on high, he led captivity captive, what that means, he took those who would have enshackled him and he put them in chains and he led them in procession. And in doing that, he also gave gifts to men. What Paul is doing is drawing on this idea of a Roman triumph to say Jesus was the true king who led the true triumph, and he took Satan and the demons and all his dominion and put them in chains and marched them behind him as he ascended back to the Father, covered in the red blood of his cross. When I understood that connection for the first time, I realize that the ascension means so much more than we've ever thought it does. I want to go back to the book of Daniel chapter 7, and I want to see this event from the other perspective. In Daniel chapter 7, Daniel is able to access, through God's grace, he is able to access a vision of the throne of God. And he's talking about this in verses 13 down through, back in verses 9 through 12. He's talking about being in front of the Ancient of Days, and his garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame. Daniel's saying, I was there in the throne room of God. And look at verses 13 and 14. He says, I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him before him. Now, I want to just stop for a moment. A lot of our religious friends in the world today turn to Daniel 7 and verse 13, and they see Jesus, this being a picture of the second coming of Christ, of the return of Jesus from heaven back to earth. But notice the language. Daniel doesn't stutter. Daniel is there in the presence of God, and notice what he says in verse 13. The one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven, and he came to the Ancient of Days. He's coming from afar to back home. Like the general who had gone off into a foreign country to fight a war, he's coming home now victorious. Daniel is seeing this triumph parade from the throne of heaven. He is seeing the ascension of Christ. You say, how do you know that? Go to the book of Acts chapter 1, and you know the story. I don't even have to turn there and read it. But Jesus is there talking with his disciples, and as they're speaking, he is caught up in a what? Cloud, and taken up back to the Father. Daniel gives us the rest of what happens. Luke doesn't know anymore because he's on earth. Daniel is there through this prophetic vision in heaven, and he sees Jesus now coming, and notice what happens when he comes. It says in verse 14, then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the ones which shall not be destroyed. Brothers and sisters, the death, the burial, and the resurrection of Jesus Christ is absolutely essential to our faith. And I believe also in 1 Corinthians 15, there's a fourth thing that we leave off. Paul says that he was seen by over 500 people at once. I think if we're going to obey the gospel, once we're baptized and we rise to walk in a newness of life, others have to see that evidence of new life in us. You don't stop at the baptistry and go back to living. You've got to be seen by those around you. But there's another part to the gospel that may be the best news of all. And that's when Jesus led the triumph parade back to heaven. Paul, or the Hebrews writer, tells us in Hebrews 9 that Jesus, the great high priest, by the way, I didn't even put that point in there. Not long after Julius Caesar was dead, there was another civil war, and this time it was between Mark Antony and Octavian, who would later be known as Augustus Caesar. You may remember him from Luke chapter 2 and verse 1. It came to pass in those days there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. Caesar Augustus, or Augustus Caesar, Octavian, another name, he was the first Roman emperor in his full force. And he was the adopted son of Julius Caesar. He was actually his nephew. But he'd been adopted and given the name Caesar and given his title. And that's why Rome surrounded him. And that's why Mark Antony ended up going down with old Cleopatra in Egypt. And so we see that what happens is that they gave the title to Julius Caesar, the God, or the Son of God. And this made Caesar Augustus the Son of God, literally on their coinage. And you can find coinage. In fact, when Jesus gets that coin out of the fish's mouth and says, whose inscription is on this? It was Caesar's. And there have been Tiberius Caesar, the son of Augustus, or the follower, the successor to Augustus, who lived a very long life, lived 75 years. His successor had on his coinage minted Tiberius Caesar, a son of God. But the real son of God was Jesus. And he was the one who had claim to the throne. Now, the thing I didn't tell you earlier is that Julius was also called the Pontificate Maximus, or in other words, the chief priest. The Roman emperor, the one led in triumph, was also the head of the Roman imperial religion. And so there's so much tied up in this imagery, isn't it now? And so Jesus is now our high priest, going to the true city of the people of God, taking his own blood, not red from Jupiter, but he's taking his blood to the throne of God to offer for us. And in triumphal procession, as it were, I'm not saying he took the devil to heaven, but as it were, when he was raised from the dead, he triumphed over the devil. And as he had said in John 12:31, the ruler of this world will be cast out. And he now is showing the world, I've made a spectacle of them, Colossians 2 and verse 15. Now, I've said quite a lot in setting up the rest of the sermon. By the way, it's after the resurrection and after the ascension that what does Jesus say? All authority is what? Been given to me in heaven and on earth, Matthew 28 and 18, shortly before his ascension. And when we read about him in Revelation 17, 14 and 19, 16, he is now called the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords because he conquered them all. Now, there's four things tonight, and they won't take as long as these three, I promise. So hang in here. Four quick things tonight, four facts that you need to know since Jesus is the triumphant King. Number one, he is in control. I hope you'll go and meditate on Psalm 2. I have a suspicion where most of your political alliances lie, so I'm going to step out on this branch gently. Did you ever, in the year 2000, think that you'd be facing an election where one candidate had signs of dementia and had used Genesis 1, 26 and 27, in the image of God, he created man, male and female, he created them, to defend transgender rights. And the conservative Christian's favorite candidate on the other side had just been arrested that had something to do with money being paid because he had had an affair with his wife to a pornographic actress. Did you ever think 20 years ago that those would be that this would happen? And I know people get angry with me for even mentioning those things, but let's be real. Our leaders are woefully lacking in morality and character all around. And if we are looking to be saved at the election booth, we are going to be disappointed. Brothers and sisters in Christ, when it seems like our world is out of control, we need to remember that Jesus is the triumphant King. In Psalm 2, the whole psalm is dedicated to the idea that the Son of God holds those who would oppose him in derision. Now, that word there means he laughs at them. Have you ever had a younger cousin or a younger brother or sister that got mad at you and wanted to beat you up, and you were big enough that you could just put your hand on their head and hold them out there, and they'd just be fighting and swinging if they could, and then you got to laughing at them? What'd that do to that little brother or sister or cousin? It made them just really mad then, and they swung twice as hard, but they couldn't do anything because you're so much bigger. This is the picture that's painted in Psalm 2. That Jesus will dash these nations in pieces with a rod of iron, and he will rule over them with an iron scepter. He is King. And so the first point tonight is, since Jesus is in control, I have confidence for the future. The second thing I want to point out tonight is that his reign is righteous. In Revelation 19, revisiting that text again in verse 11, we read that Jesus is the just one. In 2 Timothy 4 and verse 1, we read that the one who will judge the living and the dead and his appearing in his kingdom is Jesus Christ, the righteous. Now, what does that mean? That means that Jesus will never do anything that could come up for indictment. Jesus will never do anything that will treat you wrong. He will never, ever in his kingdom rule in such a way that is unfair or unrighteous towards you. And his character and the quality of him and his person can never be questioned. Jesus is the perfect King. I mentioned earlier that Solomon was a tragic picture of Jesus because Solomon was given, you know, he started off, David has set him up. He's got the shepherd's heart to bring him up as a father. And Solomon here is pictured as this one who's so humble that he asks God for wisdom instead of treasure or long life. And God grants him the wisdom to rule over his people. And Solomon builds this amazing temple and sacrifices all these animals. And if we're reading that story, we get excited because, man, and the next chapter, he loves all these foreign women, and his heart follows after them. And because of that, he goes after foreign gods. And we're reminded, don't put your trust in a man, even a great man, because every one of them will disappoint you. Jesus is the only one that will never disappoint you. The third thing we want to observe tonight is His rule is eternal. I love what Daniel 7 says there when He is given a kingdom. It says His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and His kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. Now that answers a vision that Daniel gives us earlier in the book in chapter 2 and verse 44 when he sees Nebuchadnezzar's multi-metallic image, and we see that stone cut out of the mountain without hands, and it breaks in pieces and smashes that image, and that rock, that stone grows into a mountain and fills the whole earth. And we read in Daniel 2:44, in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. May I be just a little blunt with you tonight? For several years, I've been tired of negativity in the church, and I don't listen to it very long. Everywhere I go, well, our best days are behind us. We're going downhill. Boy, we used to have this. Nobody loved it. Preachers are bad. They'll complain about the brethren, and the brethren complain about the preachers, and everybody talks about how everything in the past was better and everything in the future looks terrible. If that is your attitude that you're putting out into your community and to your fellow church members, then everything will be terrible in your church. Friends, I'm a part of God's everlasting kingdom, and the King I serve is ruling forever, and His reign won't be overthrown. And frankly, it doesn't matter if secularism is growing in America, and it doesn't matter if church attendance in America is shrinking and people would rather go hit a ball with a stick than they would to worship the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter. There are more Christians on our planet today than have ever been here on this planet since Jesus walked the earth. Do you understand that? That the church is the largest now that it's ever been. It may be in places like India. It may be in places like Africa or South America. But folks, there are multitudes of Christ's subjects around the world doing His will. And I don't know about where you are or what you see, but I'd invite you to come down to camp. We open registration, by the way, today. Last year we filled up our, we makeshift built two extra cabins last year, and we filled them all up, and we had a wait list of 20 kids to come to camp. Our churches are full of young people going around and preaching and leading singing and serving. The future is bright when we understand that Jesus is still King and His kingdom will never be destroyed. Some of us act like the age of the church is over. Because His rule is eternal, I have hope. And finally tonight, His subjects are willing servants. Jesus said in Revelation 3 and verse 20 to the church at Laodicea, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If you'll open that door, I'll come in and eat with you. But you have to open the door." There may come a time in our country where we're forced to not say certain things under penalty of law or do certain things under penalty of law. In fact, in the days of Jesus, not very long after that, within 100 years or so, the people of God would be forced to bow down to Caesar or to claim Him as God under penalty of death or horrific torture. And many of those Christians ended up being those souls under the altar in Revelation crying out, how long, O Lord, holy and true, until You avenge our blood?" But the fact of the matter is, no one has ever served Jesus that did not choose to serve Jesus. Paul says, "For by grace are you saved through faith, and that not of yourselves, it's the gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast. For we are His workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works." In Colossians 3, verses 1 through 3, Paul talks about that we should set our mind on things above and not on things of the earth. He says, "For you died and your life is hidden with Christ in God." Both of these texts, both of these scriptures show us the group of people who through faith chose to live a new way and follow King Jesus. Now tonight as we wrap, by the way, that tells me that there's a place I want to be. I didn't put it on the screen, but if you want to jot down, and I meant to, Matthew 11, 28 through 30, Jesus offers an invitation to us. He says, "Come unto me, And you don't have to listen. You can put all your hope in a political candidate the next time around. And when they disappoint you, I hope you'll remember that I told you tonight that Jesus never will. Jesus is the triumphant King. And everything I hope to attain or achieve one day has been done by Him. When He rose from the grave and took His own blood to the throne room of heaven to present there on the altar in the Holy of Holies before God our Father. And in doing so, He led captivity captive. He took the devil and all his power away. And he went into the strong man's house and He bound the strong man. And Paul also says He gave gifts to men. Just like the Roman emperors would throw bread and trinkets to the people, Jesus sent His Spirit back down to the earth. Boy, that'd be a whole nother sermon. And that Spirit inspired men who preached the gospel and helped the church to grow and gave us today the Word of God that we preach and we believe and we know that leads us to love and serve that same King. I've never been to a triumph, but I want to tell you all about it. And I hope you know the story of the greatest triumph that's ever been thrown. It wasn't on earth and it wasn't in Rome. It wasn't in Jerusalem. It was in heaven when our King celebrated His victory. If you'd like to be His follower tonight, you can be. You can become His follower through faith and through obedience.